This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Why can some people kick their drug habit cold turkey and others never succeed? That's a question that Dr. Drew Pinsky still struggles with after nearly two decades as the medical director of a substance abuse ward at Las Encinas Hospital in Pasadena, California. His job is to get them over the initial hurdle of withdrawal, to treat the disease of addiction, what it's done to his patients' bodies and minds, and to help them begin to face the long process of staying straight. He's co-authored a book about his work with substance abusers. It's called Cracked, A Doctor's Story. You might know Dr. Pinsky by his radio persona, Dr. Drew, the unflappable co-host with Adam Carolla of a Los Angeles-based syndicated sex advice talk show for teenagers, Loveline. It ran as a television program for five seasons on MTV in the 90s. Pinsky says that many of his patients arrive at the hospital in critical condition. They've overdosed. Sometimes they're violent or delusional. I asked him what's involved in stabilizing someone who's near death from drug intoxication.
They're under the influence. Their brains are in the grips of a biology that changes all their motivational priorities, changes how they think, changes how they behave. And in those settings, they can be wild. They can be complaining overwhelming pain. They can be overcome by anxiety and agitation. They can be manic. I mean, the presentations are protean in terms of how people come to the table. For the most part, patients are unable to get out of bed. They are miserable. They are maybe unstable medically. Their vital signs may need regular monitoring. And they're certainly unstable psychiatrically. They're either profoundly depressed or quite manic or terribly agitated. And our unit the members of my team on our unit are specifically trained to be able to contain and address these issues both behaviorally and pharmacologically.
Well, I think everyone knows or has heard that withdrawal is painful, but it sounds from what you write that it's not only psychologically but physically painful. It's excruciating.
Yeah. I'll tell you this. Opiate addicts are the ones that go through some of the most miserable withdrawals. Benzodiazepine addicts, Soma addicts, these are things that are very uncomfortable. And it depends which drug you're withdrawing from. If it's an alcoholic, yes, it's terribly uncomfortable. They're very dysphoric. They're extremely agitated. And if they actually get into DTs, they have about a 60% fatality rate. So there's a very, very serious medical issue to be attended to. If you're coming off, say, a drug like Soma, there's an agitation and something called akathisia. They feel like they want to crawl out of their skin, and they're rocking constantly and moving constantly, can't sit still. Opiate addicts get a crushing bone pain in their back and their legs. One of the reasons I want to raise awareness about this is many people who think they have chronic pain actually have opiate addiction. They're just in this chronic state of withdrawal where the opiates actually cause back pain, cause headaches. And we have to sit them down and take them off the opiates cold turkey. They scream with pain for 2 days, and then they're fine. Then their pain magically goes away, and they never have pain again, until they're stressed, and then we sort of help them manage that. But no one ever gets them through those few days, which, by the way, once they're through it, they really don't even remember. They really have very little recollection of those days that are so miserable. And the hard part is the staying off part, the treatment part, the rehabilitation. That's what takes the time. That's actually the most painful piece of this story, and that's the part where the hard work is so very necessary.
Well, I think the irony, at least at first, of what you're trying to do is that to get people off of drugs, the whole time they're begging you night and day for something to take the pain away.
Yes.
And you do have to manage their pain with medication in order to get them through this initial stage of withdrawal.
That's very true.
Yeah, give us an idea of the challenges of walking that line, giving them enough medication but not too much.
Well, I don't use medications that activate the reward system. You've got to understand that addiction is a disease of a deep limbic structure. It is literally a biological alteration of your survival systems, of your drive systems. It alters the motivational priorities of the brain. So anything that massages that feeds into that biology will activate the drives of this disease. So specifically, we use medications that compensate for the hyperactivity of the brain caused by the chronic saturation of the drugs, but without reaching into that limbic structure. It's a deep, deep structure of the brain that has no logic, has no reason, doesn't even have language, and you can't communicate with it. All it does is send out drive, and as a result, colors everything that goes on in your brain, colors thought process, colors priorities, colors everything. And if we activate it with our pharmacology, we turn the volume up on that, and there's no way they're going to stay sober then. We try to attack at similar receptor systems without massaging the same problem.
What's that like for you, though? And you do write about the drama of borderline personalities, and many addicts are borderline. And and their charm and their charisma.
I wrote that intentionally, yeah.
First of all, they look at you as a capsule on legs. You are drug.
Yeah, I'm open for business. That's all they say, is open for business. Essentially, all addicts, when they come to treatment, are at least functioning at a primitive personality level. They may not necessarily have a personality disorder, though many of them do. 100% of my patients are trauma survivors. So that is to say, of those patients who require inpatient psychiatric chemical dependency treatment, 100% have a trauma history in childhood. And as such, we see lots of people with sociopathy, antisocial personalities, and borderline and narcissistic personality disorders, so-called cluster B personality disorders. And these people are very manipulative, very charming, they make you feel great, but their goal is to get from you what they want. And for me, they want drugs, because I got the prescription pad. And so they'll do anything they can. Now, for women, the reason I made Amber, it's one of the main characters in this book, an attractive female, is I wanted to point out how much we as a culture do not address the issue of boundaries between men and women, particularly as it pertains to men in authority. And we have lots of people, 1 out of 3 women in our country are sexually abused. We have lots of trauma survivors. And as such, women such as Amber learn to expect exploitation. They literally are professional victims. And so when they come up to a male, they immediately present for exploitation. And when you set a boundary, they become ashamed and they get angry and they don't know how to interact with that male. And my point was, what does it feel like as a male to give them what they need, as opposed to engage in the exploitation that is so common in our culture, with doctors to go on with patients, teachers with students, presidents with interns, whatever. This exactly the opposite of what they need is to go along with that, what they need, and what our responsibility is as people in authority is to set the boundary and to be with them while they go through the frustration of not being able to be a victim again.
One of the main characters in your book is a young woman named Amber. She doesn't want to get well. And you write somewhere in the book that you, at any given time, might have a whole hospital full of patients who don't want to get well, who don't really get it.
Don't get it. I wanted to call the book Getting It at one point. And that's such a fascinating process. What does it take for somebody, even people that come in thinking they want to get well, when they don't fully capitulate to the process, they don't completely take direction? Remember, these people are often trauma survivors. So the capacity that they have to trust authority figures is extremely impaired. So a guy like me who comes along trying to help in a white coat, no way. They're not going to listen to what I have to say. They're going to reserve the right for themselves. Powerlessness has been the sentinel experience in their life that they're trying to avoid. And they're now powerless over this biology. And here now someone in authority is telling them, oh, feel powerless. That's your first step. And trust me and take my direction. And unless you take my direction completely, you'll be using your diseased brain to make decisions. And you will, because of the motivational priorities of that diseased brain, you'll find your way back to drugs. When they do finally get it, they capitulate. They let go. They follow all directions. We can tell when somebody gets it, when they don't. And we know they're going to relapse if they don't get it.
Well, I think that's what most people don't get about addiction. They think it just takes grit to get through this.
No,
you write that it's really something of a mystery to you why some people finally turn that corner and say
it is a mystery. Yeah.
And commit themselves to getting over addiction. What do your patients say about this?
My patients say it's God, to a person. I can always tell when they're there. If those that have been terribly, terribly resistant, they'll all of a sudden start talking about something stepping in, something took over. I can't explain it, but all of a sudden some spiritual experience filled me and I was ready. I'm bewildered and awed by that. And maybe it is God, maybe it's some biology that turns on. I don't know what it is, but I sure know when they're there. And I know those that especially need it, the opiate addicts and the polydrug addicts. So, you know, if you're an alcoholic and you're fighting a tough biology, but not nearly the biology of these polydrug and opiate addicts, and you decide you want to get well, you can kind of focus on your treatment and get well, and you will gain a spiritual understanding, but they don't have these profound spiritual awakenings that the more severe addicts seem to need to get it. Now, I don't know if that's a function of the biology, the spirituality, or the pre-existing trauma that tends to motivate people towards polydrug addiction in the first place.
Well, the pattern that you see recurring through so many of your patients' lives is that they can't connect with other people, and that's what, in part, makes them susceptible to drugs. And then once they're addicted, the circuitry of their brain becomes rewired, and that has its own self-perpetuating effects.
But precisely.
But how do you understand the lack of connection and getting over that?
Well, the lack of connection is sort of being worked out now by the attachment theorists, guys like Peter Fonagy and Alan Shore. They're coming up with biological mechanisms that explain why when people are traumatized, they literally lose the capacity to explore other minds. And it is actually through the exploration of other minds that we build the map of our of a second-order representation of who we are, a symbolic representation, so we can understand and regulate our feelings. If we are traumatized, if we are abused interpersonally, if we are led to feel that the possibility of our going on being is to be interrupted by somebody we rely upon for our safety and well-being, we lose that capacity for connection. We are fearful of exploring other minds for fear of what we might find there, and we become reliant on much more primitive mechanisms that are in place at the time in which we are traumatized. And now we're an adult, we're using drugs as a way of regulating, and another authority figure steps in and says, trust me, connect to me. No way. They can't do it. The biology literally is not there. So we have to slowly get them to connect with us. And again, that's part of that sort of spiritual awakening. Sometimes they just get it and start trusting and start connecting.
We're back with Dr. Drew Pinsky. He's the medical director of a rehab clinic in California. You may know him as Dr. Drew, the co-host of the syndicated talk show Loveline. Pinsky has been on the air for 20 years, answering questions young people have about sexuality. He says when he started, frank discussions on the radio about sex were rare.
The term safe sex had not been identified yet. HIV had not been isolated. We were still calling AIDS gay-related intestinal disease syndrome, GRIDS. The condoms were behind the counter. You had to ask the pharmacist to bring them forward. And as far as the American public was concerned, young people that age, probably not having sex at all. At least we don't talk to them about it. So I knew what these people were doing. I'd just been through it, and I knew what young people were about, and I knew what they needed. I knew I had this body of information that was so simple that no one was presenting to them. The biology of the function of their reproductive systems and the sexually transmitted diseases and contraception was all still shrouded in mystery at that point. They just needed the facts, and so I sat down and tried to give them to them.
So what was the turning point for the show? Did it take off when you got the co-host that it became identified with Loveline, Adam Carolla?
Yeah, at that point it seemed to move it along quite a bit. That went to TV and five nights a week and syndicated radio. The reason I appreciate working with Adam, although we have two very, very different jobs, one is tends to give me room to do what I need to do. And two, he captures the eyes and ears so I can deliver the information. I understand that you must entertain or you don't get the information across. Me in a white coat in a box is not going to reach kids at risk.
Well, that's the thing about the show. For people who haven't seen it, it's you and Adam. Well, it was for 5 years. It was a television show on MTV, but who haven't heard it on the radio, it's you and Adam Carolla talking to people, callers who call in asking questions about their sex life, often about very graphic problems they're having. They talk about masturbation. They talk about everything. They talk about fetishes. And Adam Carolla, who went on to co-host the Man Show, takes the persona of the kind of goofy, sometimes misogynist. He's the guy with the jokes.
He's the entertainment.
And he often is, if not insulting, inappropriate, and seems to make you uncomfortable.
Oh, always uncomfortable for me. But he sort of pushes on these things intentionally. He pushes on the boundaries of propriety and sort of even push on race issues and things like that just to be kind of outrageous. But ultimately, we both take it back to the same point, which is the vast majority of our callers, interestingly enough, are trauma survivors. And so we even have techniques we use. You probably haven't heard this on the radio. We bet. We hear a certain voice, a certain feeling is evoked in us, and within 10 or 15 seconds, we'll say, we're going to bet on you. The reason we'll bet each other a buck that we can predict what happened to this person at what age. And we're uncanny in our ability to predict what age they were physically or sexually abused or abandoned or whatever the issue was. We can feel it. The people, they just evoke it in us. And the reason we came up with this crazy little technique is we got tired of people going, no, I've dealt with that. That's not me, or denying it. And if we come to them and say, here's what happened then, and they go, yeah, that's what happened. Okay, well, how did we magically know this? And how do we magically know that's the issue and why you're manifesting these horrible behaviors now? It just makes that point for people. And so we can't solve your problem in 3 minutes on the radio. You need treatment. Anybody with behaviors like this suggests that there's something really going on with them psychiatrically or psychologically. Think about it. Don't just exploit. Don't just behave. Think about why these behaviors are gratifying for you, why things aren't working for you anymore, and what it means about how you're put together psychologically.
Well, is it your impression that teenagers don't know that much about sex because they aren't really talking to their parents about it or each other in a meaningful way?
We know way too much about sex. That's not the problem. We're trying to take that from the explicit to the human. In other words, because you're having a threesome, it's going to ruin your relationship. It's going to ruin your marriage. What the hell do you need that kind of arousal for? What's the matter with your experience of intimacy that you have to do this? Why can't you say no to your partner when they want to do that? And why would you choose a partner that would exploit you like that? We use it as a doorway into a more human understanding of these things. We've gone through a 30-year period when sexuality has been the solution. It has now become the problem. It's like a drug in our culture. Kids look upon it as a way of managing how they're feeling as opposed to a way of expressing intimacy. And we have such disturbed family systems and kids that have such impairments of their ability to regulate their affective lives that naturally enough they look to these things as their solution.
There's this trend now of hooking up, and this is a colloquialism used among teenagers and college-age kids. Can you tell us what exactly it means, and what's your take on hooking up?
Okay. Well, the Independent Women's Forum, a think tank, women's advocacy group in Washington, did a study a couple of years ago where they went to college-age women and said, well, what's your social life like? You happy? And they found something very surprising. Nearly 100% of the women they surveyed at several hundred institutions came back with not so happy or ambivalent, but none happy, very few very happy, mostly sort of ambivalent to unhappy. So then they went back and said, well, why? What's going on socially? What are your choices? Well, they found that women in all institutions had the same three choices in their social lives. They could, one, hook up, which are these physical encounters, one night, no relationship implied. In fact, avoid it at all costs. It can mean anything from holding hands to some sort of explicit contact. It's always shrouded in mystery. They intentionally do that for reasons that's a mystery to me. Always intoxicated. 100% of the time, they're loaded when they do this. Number two, they can become joined at the hip, where it's these rapidly developing relationships with someone that you're not even sure you want to be in with, but pow, all of a sudden you're boyfriend or girlfriend. Or three, you can be a friends with benefits. That's where you're just a friend and you kind of have sex over time. Now, the friends with benefits, always a disaster for somebody because we're human beings. We develop feelings. Shocking. And somebody gets hurt as a result. My challenge to the college-age kids when I speak to them is, if hooking up is such a cool thing, why do you have to get loaded to do it? Well, in every single room, and I speak to rooms with 800 to 2,000 kids in it, every single room the response is exactly the same. The men and the women have completely different opinions about why they're getting loaded. The men are getting loaded because they want to hook up. It's the absolute goal. It's perfect for what their motivational priorities are. But it's so anxiety-provoking that in order to get the job done, they got to get loaded. Women are getting loaded to tolerate this situation. It's not what they want, but they'll tolerate it by getting loaded. And so then I asked the women, well, paint the picture for me what the social environment would look like if it could just be that you would be comfortable. You wouldn't have to get loaded. It would be something you'd want. What would you do? And every single room, so a woman will raise her hand immediately and say, I wish a guy would just sit down and talk to me. And the guys are like, what do you mean? Well, and then I say, well, how about if they called you back again and sat down and talked to you again? Oh my God, that would be unbelievable. Well, that's a date. So really, we need some sort of courtship ritual again, don't we, to intervene between the hookup and the meeting, or between the meeting and the becoming joined at the hip. And they actually agree with that. And so right now they're in a situation where this whole hooking up culture is making them kind of unhappy and anxious and requiring them to find ways of managing these very intense situations, namely drugs and alcohol.
Drew Pinsky, you have three children. You have triplets, 10-year-old triplets, right?
Oh, my God.
Are you comfortable talking with them about sexuality?
No, of course not. I'm just a parent. And each of them is different. Why couldn't they all be the same? Why couldn't I get through one of them and then the next two will be just the same? Each of them has their own person, and as a result, we have to have our own strategy for dealing with these things with them. But I do know clearly that you've got to establish that dialogue between the age of 8 and 12, research shows, and so we're working hard at it. And interestingly, my daughter, we're in. She's dialoguing, you know, we have quite an open dialogue with her. The boys, shut down. It's impossible. And so we're trying. Interestingly, my wife is having more success with getting them to talk about this stuff than I. And I think the important thing to remember when you are talking to young kids and trying to get a dialogue established is that's the goal. Get the dialogue established. You're not trying to give them a plumbing lesson. It's not the amount or quality of the information so much as the opportunity for them to comfortably dialogue with you about these personal and difficult issues. So as they emerge through puberty and earlier later adolescence, they will come to you for the answers. 85% of kids say they want the information from their parents. Very few get it from the parents. And again, the science suggests that if you haven't established the dialogue by the age of 12, it's very difficult to establish a dialogue, and you tend to lose them to the ambient culture and their peers.
So how far have you gotten?
Depends on the child. My daughter's, you know, she comes to us with everything, and I'll have to say things like, how much you want to know? Yeah, I'm going to start. You tell me when to stop. And a few words into it, she's like, no, oh my God, stop. I think, that's right. Yes, done my job. No. She comes to us with her questions, and we just answer them. The important thing also is to keep it on their level. Answer the questions they want answered, and just answer them. Don't later on, shape it, color it, put your values in. But when they want to answer about a difficult question, just give them the facts.
Well, Dr. Drupinski, I really enjoyed talking with you today. Thank you.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you, Barbara.
Drupinski's new book is called Cracked,